KALW.
Some things that stress me out is school. Me being worried about homework, tests, worried about the next quiz.
Today, we hear stories about dealing with stress and anxiety.
Don't be judgmental. I think that's important. Don't be in denial, because oftentimes, it's right in front of you.
Sights and Sounds host Janae Darden shares how support from her mother helped her cope with depression as a kid.
Sometimes, you know, children, they may not talk to their parents about what's going on. And I said, well, maybe she'll talk to someone else.
And what happens when the thing that helps you cope becomes part of the problem?
It hasn't really made it that much easier or faster or better, which is like so stupid. It makes me feel so stupid.
Personal perspectives on mental health. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. So do you know the signs of stress? We all face it in different ways, at different times in our lives. Here's a Burton High School student sharing his thoughts.
It's Matthew Vila. I'm a senior at Burton High School, and I'm going to be talking about stress. What are signs of stress? Signs of stress are feeling overwhelmed, the feeling of worry and mental turmoil, being anxious, scared, even sleeping problems. According to Mr. Wade, our wellness director, about 60 people a day come to wellness, which is a safe mental space for everyone, in Burton to talk about anything, mainly about stress. I asked everyone, what should a school do to support wellness? And everyone said the same thing, to normalize the topic and to educate more people, because for some people, wellness and mental health is not important. Some things that stress me out is school. Me being worried about homework, tests, worried about the next quiz, you know, things like that. Another thing that stressed me out is my parents. Their pressure on me to graduate high school and to get a good job, finish college, to take care of my brothers, to help them financially, etc. That stressed me out because I'm just a kid and I want to worry about games or volleyball, basketball, things like that. It kind of worries me because what if I don't make it? What if I don't graduate high school? What if I don't graduate college? The way that I deal with my stress is hang out with friends, going to the mall, eating in a restaurant, just hanging out, having a good time, playing volleyball, exercising, and meditating, which I find relaxing and soothing for me. Everyone deals with stress. It's important to normalize it and talk about it. It's very important to let your peers know, your family know, so they can better help you mentally and physically.
This year is shaping up to be a contentious election year, one that's already marked with distressing headlines. So we thought it might be helpful to pause, take a deep breath, and consider mental health. Today, we'll hear stories of people who were in difficult mental spaces and how they found their way out. We'll begin with a segment from our Bayview series, where we ask someone to share an aspect of their life that touches on a larger issue. KALW reporter, author, and Sights and Sounds host Janae Darden shares her personal experience dealing with depression through poetry. Here she is, starting with her poem, Battleground.
They said Black girls from East Oakland are supposed to be tough. Daintiness is not an option. Feeling pain is not an option. They said Black women don't have time to be depressed. The early years of my mental health journey felt like a battle, not just with myself, but with others' opinions of how I should see myself. 1993, I was living my 8th grade, 13-year-old life in East Oakland. And for the most part, things were good. Back then, you would have caught me shopping at the swap meet in Durant Square, watching music videos on the local cable station Soul Beat, or reading my mother's Jackie Collins novels. And on a special day, my grandmother would call me to come over for cabbage, yams, and cornbread. I lived for her cooking. Yeah, there was a lot of violence in the community too, and luckily my family was able to keep me safe. Middle school life was a bit more challenging. I was a prissy, nerdy Black girl, a target for bullies at my predominantly Black Catholic school. Like Michelle Obama, other kids said I acted white because I earned good grades and spoke proper English. As for the taunts about my body, yeah, I had small boobs. They were like honor roll, straight A's, get it? But the attacks about my skin complexion broke me down. I've been tricked into thinking that the color pink was only restricted to the honeycomb light brown shades that are not me. It looked good on Malibu Barbie and the light-skinned girl who sat in front of my class. But when I dared to wear my favorite color, I only got teases and laughs. They said pink was too feminine for a dark-skinned girl like me. Beauty is not an option for dark girls. Colorism. Alice Walker defines it as prejudicial or preferential treatment of same-race people based solely on their color. For those of us girls with darker complexions, we face prejudices because our features are farthest from what is considered the beauty standard, white. I grew to hate what I saw in the mirror, and I prayed I had the fair complexions of Jasmine Guy from A Different World or Martin's Tisha Campbell. The girls that look like them, they always got the guy. The girls that look like me were the sidekicks. My mood slowly died. And this descent accelerated when I began high school. Adjusting was a challenge. I had a hard time making new friends, which made me hate myself more. Negative thoughts played on repeat in my head. I'm not cute. Nobody likes me. This was deeper than needing a self-esteem boost. Huh? Self-esteem? Where do you get that, I asked. Does it come in a lotion bottle or a jar, like beauty cream? Has Oprah given it away in her favorite things? Is it easy to put on, like a clip in my hair? Hold up. Does it come with Obamacare? Self-esteem. They make it sound like it's the answer, no doubt. But how is self-esteem the key in a world that constantly tries to lock Black women out? Occasionally, I have anxiety attacks on school nights. My heart would race and it felt like there wasn't enough oxygen in the room. My mom thought this was just nerves from me working hard in school. I hid my negative feelings until I couldn't anymore. My mom found a runaway note. I wanted to leave because I felt like a burden and a terrible person.
And I said, okay, there's something wrong.
She took me to a therapist with the quickness.
Yeah, it was my first idea. I knew that it was something that I couldn't handle. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, children, they may not talk to their parents about what's going on. And I said, well, maybe she'll talk to someone else.
At 14, my therapist diagnosed me with depression. I went to my appointment every week. At first, I didn't know what to expect. Would the therapist think I was out of control, helpless? I carried a lot of stigma. Aren't therapists for crazy people? I'm smart. Why couldn't I fix this myself? My stigma had a cultural angle, too. I thought I failed at being a strong Black woman. Black people survived slavery, and I'm better off than my ancestors. What do I have to be upset about? Even my pastor had me questioning myself. I remember him saying that people with depression need to be better Christians. These are the kind of things Black people struggling with mental health challenges hear from others and internalize. Stigma often deters people from seeking out help. But for many African Americans, quality mental health care isn't even accessible. First of all, it can be expensive. And finding a therapist who shares your culture isn't easy. About 5% of therapists in the United States are Black, while 84% are white. Inequality of care has caused some Black patients not to trust mental health providers. Black people are disproportionately misdiagnosed and over-medicated, and not getting the proper treatment can make things worse. I'm grateful I had a positive experience. My doctor was a Black woman, so she really helped me through the colorism because she understood the issue. She did not prescribe meds, but talking to her felt more like talking to a family friend. She listened to me and made me feel normal. Eventually, I learned to embrace my dark brown skin for multiple reasons. Therapy helped, and my mother bought me books and magazines with photos of gorgeous Black women with hues similar to Viola Davis or Lupita Nyong'o.
Right. So you could see that, you know, dark-skinned Black women are beautiful. Always have been.
This may come as a shock, but charm school had an impact. My mom sent me to a charm school run by a Black woman that focused on inner self-love. Researching colorism further enlightened me on the historical roots of my pain. And writing in my journal gave me some peace of mind. Still, through the years, I battled depression and carried lots of shame. I continued to secretly go to therapy up until my 20s. But things really began to change in my 30s. Broke and unemployed, thanks to the Great Recession, journalism jobs were scarce. I took a communications job at a nonprofit in East Oakland that advocates for people with mental health challenges. This was one of the best decisions I ever made. I met people from all sorts of cultures with bipolar, schizophrenia, depression, addiction, etc., and they taught me I have nothing to be ashamed of. So when I left that job a few years later, I left with a gift, self-compassion. I'm the purple rose who blooms. At times, I've grown during long droughts, alone in the darkness, but somehow come out brighter, glowing right with the rainbows. I'm the purple rose who blooms vibrantly. For the little Black girls who are lied to, told their dreams are impossible, I reflect possibility. I've learned to stay afloat when the blues weigh me down, like writing poetry or having a wellness plan for when triggers come. But none of this would have been possible without the initial actions and ongoing support of my mother.
For any parent listening out there, what advice do you have for them if they have a child that's struggling with depression or a mental health challenge?
Don't be judgmental. I think that's important. Don't be in denial, because oftentimes it's right in front of you, but you know, you say to yourself, "Oh, it's just a phase they're going through. Oh, they'll get over it. It's no, you know, no, get it evaluated."
I share my story so other people know they're not the only ones suffering. I still have my challenges and go to therapy. Some days are better than others, but I know that living with depression doesn't mean I'm weak. No matter who you are, it takes a lot of strength to deal with this thing. But that's life. It comes with beauty and thorns. I'm Janae Darden for Cross Currents, and this is my Bayview.
That was KLW's Janae Darden. Her book of poems is called When a Purple Rose Blooms. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. These past 5 years have taken a toll on us. During the pandemic, substance abuse went up, and experts say there was a strong connection between the stress of the pandemic and increased drug and alcohol use nationwide. In 2022, substance abuse began to go back down to pre-pandemic levels, but it's still a big issue in the country. There's an ongoing opioid epidemic involving prescription opioids since at least 1999. When it comes to prescription medication, there's a lot out there that can help treat different symptoms, but they can also come with the risk of addiction. KLW's Ren Farrell had that on his mind in 2021 after nearly a year of lockdown, and he wanted to take a look at one of the personal stories behind these statistics. Here's Ren.
For personal and professional reasons, I've spent a lot of time thinking about addiction in the last year. I've talked to recovered addicts, counselors, people who run treatment centers. I've been all over Reddit. And I'm still not totally clear on what the difference is between being an addict and just being someone who uses drugs and alcohol to deal with stress. I wanted to talk to someone who might be grappling with that same question. Someone who had watched their relationship to substances spin out of control during the pandemic. That's how I found Kelsey. Kelsey's not her real name, but that's what we're calling her.
Great. Hot girl name. Always wanted one.
Kelsey grew up in the Bay Area. Now, she's a graduate student at an art school in Southern California. In August of 2020, she was finishing up her thesis, and she had an idea to make that easier.
I found a doctor within my insurance plan who described themselves as, like, specializing in, like, quote, academic and career success, so it was pretty easy.
She got what she was looking for, an Adderall prescription. It wasn't her first time using Adderall. that was in high school when she took the SATs. She wasn't actually sure it helped, but she took it occasionally in college too, before writing a big paper or studying for finals. She didn't think it was the kind of thing she'd get hooked on. One, because it's so expensive, and two, because it's a study drug, not a party drug.
Like, it's very, like, it, like, makes me turn inward in a really intense way. And it's kind of ironic that, yeah, people take it for fun, because I don't find it fun at all.
But she wasn't taking it for fun. No, this was for her thesis, for graduate school. The stakes were high, and it made her feel like a better writer.
I feel like I can access some part of my vocabulary, which is really strange. Like, I feel like I think anybody who writes a lot gets really tired of, like, using the same words kind of over and there just gets to a point where you're like, I suck. I know, like, 10 words. And then I feel like this other part of my, like, memory or something is accessed because I'm so concentrated.
And for a while, it felt like it was helping her get through the monotony of the pandemic.
It makes time pass really fast. So, like, I'll be reading something or working on my thesis, and when I look up and it's like nighttime, I'm like, okay, that's another day that I don't have to do again.
At first, she was just taking what she was prescribed. But by November of 2020, she was taking 40 to 65 milligrams a day, more than triple what her doctor had suggested. She knew this wasn't great, but she also just didn't see how she could stop before finishing her thesis. I know exactly what she was going through.
I think it's really common and, like, insidious. I think nobody talks about it.
Nobody talks about it. And it's also so, like, it's, like, very, like, to be not eloquent about it, it's just something that's, like, okay.
The first time I took Adderall was also in high school. I took it to study for a math test. I used Adderall in college the same way Kelsey had. Occasionally. Casually. It was like my little treat during finals week. I'd sit in a cafe and work for 10 hours straight, stopping only for cigarette breaks and to buy more coffee, or to sometimes have a really fast and weirdly intense conversation with whoever had the misfortune of running into me. I started abusing Adderall after college. I moved into a house with someone who had a prescription. She left it on the spice rack in our kitchen, right next to the paprika. She told us we could have as much as we wanted, and I took that very literally. At first, it was just one pill a day, 15 milligrams, usually around noon. It made work go by faster. I wasn't eating, so I was saving money and losing weight. It made smoking cigarettes feel amazing. But what I really liked about Adderall was that it made me feel more alert, sharper, smarter. It was like I had a cheat code to life. When 15 milligrams stopped being enough, I upped it to 30, then 45. I took a break for a few months, thought, that was weird and kind of intense, but I'm definitely not addicted or I wouldn't have been able to stop. Then I started the whole cycle over again. I did this again and again and again for almost 3 years. At the peak of my Adderall use, I was taking up to 100 milligrams a day. I was completely miserable, but I had lost control. I asked Kelsey if she felt like she had control over her use.
I don't feel anymore like I can necessarily do things without it.
Exactly. I used Adderall for work. I used it to exercise. I took it before going to bars so that I'd be better at pool. I took it before meeting up with friends, before doctor's appointments, before cleaning my room, before getting groceries. I hated myself for being so dependent on something. And as I did more and more, it became less and less helpful. But I just kept doing it.
It hasn't revolutionized the work that I produce or, like, the rate at which I produce it. Honest, that's like that is the irony. Like, it hasn't really made it that much easier or faster or better, which is, like, so stupid. It makes me feel so stupid.
After almost 3 years, I started to obsess about my dependency and to do the kind of maniacal research that you do when you're on Adderall. I'd stay up till 2, 3, 4 in the morning, deep into Reddit threads about Adderall dependency, or looking up scans of people's brains before and after heavy meth use. And then I started to get these horrible headaches. I couldn't get high anymore because they were that bad. And in May of 2020, I took Adderall for the last time. As crazy as it sounds, Until I started interviewing Kelsey, I didn't think of myself as an addict. I always had an excuse, some project or goal that justified hitting up my dealer. I told myself that this time was not going to be like the last time, that I would just take X amount for Y days to complete Z.
I don't doubt that there are people out there who like take 10 milligrams 3 days a week and it really helps them and they can like kind of compartmentalize doing that from not doing that. And I am just not one of those people and I don't know any of them.
I finally understand that I'm not one of those people either. It was like I couldn't see how Adderall actually affected me until I saw how it affected someone else. I spent a few days after our first interview feeling worried about Kelsey, and also like I owed her something for helping me to come to this realization. When she texted me a week later and told me that she had stopped taking Adderall cold turkey, I almost didn't believe her.
No, I've like stopped altogether.
Oh wow, really?
Yeah, I kind of knew. I was like, if I take any, I'm probably just going to keep taking more.
She'd had a really rough week. She'd hardly slept, hardly eaten. All she was doing was working on her thesis. One night she was up late writing, and she finally cracked.
It was just like, it was like dead quiet. And I was just in there by myself, like, and the sound of the typing was like, the sound of the typing felt as if somebody was hitting me in the head. It was like making the headache worse. And I was so exhausted and like my eyes, I'd been looking at the computer for so long and so little like observable progress had been made. Like throughout that day, which was like 12 hours, I only wrote like 4 usable pages that I just felt completely, like, I don't know how to describe it. It makes you feel like you're out of touch with reality. To be putting so much time into doing something and the yield is so, so little just really made me feel like I wasn't living in reality anymore, you know?
She spent a few days just kind of feeling what it was like to be a human again. She went outside, she ate some food, her head stopped hurting, she went to sleep. Then she threw away what was left of her prescription. I check in with her about once a week. She says she still hasn't taken any, but it hasn't been easy. The first few weeks she was really sensitive and irritable. She doesn't like that she's eating again.
I wish that I was evolved enough to say that I fully accept and love my body, but that is absolutely not true.
And she still has a lot to get done for school.
If I could take it for 2 weeks or something, like, hell yeah, I would. Like, now is maybe the first time I really wish I didn't get rid of it.
I asked her if she identifies as an addict. She says it's complicated. She doesn't want people to think that just because she had a problem with Adderall, she can't have a drink with her friends or take Molly during Mardi Gras.
I'm drinking wine right now, but like, I'm not going to drink the whole bottle, like, nor will I do that tomorrow, so.
Even if she doesn't think of herself as an addict, I like to think that every time we talk, we're basically having a meeting.
I think part of the reason why this even became a problem for me in the first place is because, like, my identity for, like, my entire young adult life has been entirely too wrapped up in and like dependent on feeling like I am intelligent. And like this thing that makes you feel, I guess, like you can access different parts of your intelligence, but not really, but it tricks you into thinking that you can. Duh, I'm gonna get like hooked on that and like not really be able to like feel joy in any other real way. Cause it's almost like there's a like dichotomy between like pleasure and joy and kind of like simple things like the moon and then being intelligent. And that's like a totally false dichotomy that's completely in my own head. But it exacerbated that already exists, you know?
Oh my God, you just like literally, that's exactly it. You just like hit the nail right on the head. Mm-hmm. I've always had this idea that you can either be like happy or you can be like
smart.
Smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely brutal.
In Oakland, I'm Ren Farrell for Cross Currents.
Ren reported that story in 2021 and now is KLW's emergency preparedness reporter. Since 2022, there's been an Adderall shortage in the country. The FDA is monitoring supply and keeping an updated list of manufacturers online. And if you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, we've posted a list of resources at kalw.org. And a note, always consult your doctor if you have questions about mental health treatment. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. A talent for sports is normally a ticket to bigger and better things.
At the end of the night, we went to a liquor store to make one last liquor pickup, you know? And we seen some guys that we were in the wrong area, I guess you could say, but I ended up getting shot. It hit me in the leg and in my hamstring and in my finger as I was getting out of the car to stand up and run. And luckily, they had already unloaded the whole clip, and they turned around and ran. And that was the beginning of the end of my career.
What it's like to chase and lose a big dream. A new story from Uncuffed tomorrow morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sarah Jesse, Lina Nagia Basuni, James Rowlands, Gonady Joe Johnson, Victor Tenz, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.